Han så over skulderen hennes mens hun bestilte, og la merke til at hun valgte filet au fish. Og med ett ble han usikker på om de to egentlig hadde så mye til felles, og om de kjente hverandre så godt som han hadde trodd at de gjorde. Og mens han tenkte på det, så snudde hun seg, og så på han med et smil som gjorde at han var helt sikker på at det skulle være de to for alltid. Og det er sånne åpenbaringer som gjør at folk står og kliner rett foran bestillingsautomaten noen ganger. Men sånn er livet. Og McDonald's er bare en liten del av det, tross alt.
Velkommen til Kjemperådet!
Hey!
Vi har fått inn et kjempenytt problem fra en mor. Jeg leser.
Yes.
Hei, jeg har en datter på 11 år som vurderer å slutte med orientering. Hun elsker jo å løpe, men finner aldri veien. Og jeg må sitte så lenge i bilen og vente.
Tricky.
Yes. Ja, men dette her har jeg opplevd selv faktisk. Og løsningen for meg ble da maps på mobilen.
Ja, hun er jo under 13 år. Da får hun 5 GB data for bare 149 kroner med Telenor.
Oi.
Hun bør jo sjekke ut nye mobilabonnement på Telenor.no da.
Yes!
En podcast fra Podplay.
Gi effektivt er denne ukas sponsor av Romkapsel. Det er snart jul, og mange av oss gir gjerne litt ekstra til gode formål sånn rundt juletider. Og på gieffektivt.no så kan du finne ut nettopp hvordan du kan gi penger og gi dem på best mulig måte som gir mest mulig nytte.
Ja, for det er jo mange gode formål som både trenger og ber om penger. Og Gi Effektivt, de kommer med anbefalinger om hvilke bistandstiltak som utretter mest godt og redder flest liv per krone du gir. Mest bang for the buck, rett og slett. Og anbefalingene, de er basert på grundige og vitenskapelige analyser. Og vitenskap, det liker vi her i Romkapsel.
Ja, for det er jo sånn at det skjer jo mye skremmende og fælt i verden for tida, og da kan man jo fort føle seg litt sånn hjelpeløs og lure veldig på hvordan man kan bidra til å hjelpe dem som har aller minst og som trenger mest. Og så er det jo ofte sånn at det som er mest tydelig og som det snakkes mest om på nyhetene og i media, kanskje ikke nødvendigvis er der hvor nøden er størst av de som trenger mest, og hvor penga gjør mest nytte.
Det er sant. Det er mye usynlig nød der ute i dag, og akkurat nå så anbefaler Gi Effektivt å gi til tiltak som bekjemper malaria, gi vitamintilskudd til underernærte barn, og sørge for at flere spedbarn får livsviktige barnevaksiner. Gi Effektivt er helt uavhengig og gir 100% av det du gir videre til hjelpeorganisasjonene. På Gi Effektivt kan du velge hvor mye du vil gi, endre faste donasjoner og selvfølgelig velge hvem du vil gi til.
Ja, og så må vi jo ta med en sånn liten sånn fotnote for oss da, rike nordmenn, at du får tilbake en god følelse, og så får du skattefradrag på det beløpet du har gitt. Så gå inn på gieffektivt.no og gi effektivt.
3, 2, 1. When lift off.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, interfere. Okay, we checked all four systems, and there you go on modulation, all four, and keying with a go.
Tranquility Base here, the Eagle has landed.
Vi er Romkapsel. Hei, Eirik. Nå gjør jeg dette for lytteren, da, ikke sant? Sånn at vi skal åpne på en fin måte, sånn som jeg prøver å gjøre.
Du er godt oppdratt, møblert hjem.
Ja, det er ikke alle oss som er det. Hjem med, og overmøblert hjem var det, og det var tunge gardiner som ikke ble brukt for å holde lyset ute. De skulle bare være der.
Så jeg er da oppvokst i Bærum og er følge en åndspygme, så jeg er glad for at noen opprettholder liksom sånn høflighetsfrasene her.
Ja, det er veldig fint i det der hippie-hjemmet som du vokste opp i.
Ja, ja, ja,
ja. Men nå er det da sånn at dette er Romkapsel. Du er, nei, vi... Du, også jeg, vi begge er fremdeles på Andøya, hvor vi skal snart foreta den offisielle åpningen. Ikke vi da, vi skal være og se på den. Kronprinsen er jo han som foretar offisielle åpninger av ting og klipper snorer. Men vi snakker med folk som holder på her oppe, gjør ting, som sørger for at raketter skytes opp snart. Og da skal vi slå over på engelsk nå, for dette er jo det gjengse arbeidsspråket, har vi skjønt her. For det er ikke snakk om sikkerhet her, det er snakk om safety, og alle er operations manager.
Yeah, this is true. So we're switching to English, and we're pretty confident that everyone who listens
will understand. Yeah.
They will understand.
Yep.
So... First, oh, yeah, we have one small stumbling block, and that's your name. Welcome, Mona Petitjean. Is that true, or how do you pronounce it?
Fair enough. So it's Mona Petitjean.
Ah. And I don't know if you noticed, but she's also not a native English speaker. So we're all friends here, yeah?
Who noticed? Yes. Okay. Why is everyone here an operations manager?
Actually, officially, there is two of them.
Okay.
And I have to say it's a strange title, kind of. It can mean a lot of different stuff. The idea with operation manager is we are the one in charge to making sure every process needed for the operation are already checked in place and everything. So, yeah, it's kind of a buzz title, but that's the idea with it.
Yeah, it looks good on a business card.
Exactly.
But I mean, operations managers have different areas of responsibilities, right? So. The previous managers, they have been covering one part because a space launch, we now have learned, is a big, complex thing with a lot of people, a lot of tasks, a lot of stuff has to happen in sort of the right order. And so what is your sort of special area of responsibility here at Anaya?
My area of responsibility is really related to the actual operation. So, for example, some of my colleagues are more taking care of kind of the paperwork,
yeah.
But I'm not a huge fan of this. So I'm more preparing the operational phase. So, for example, I make sure with the team that we are trained enough in the launch control center, that we are used to talk on the voice system, that we are used to be comfortable with, time management in operation, because it's obviously something really important.
Mm.
And it's more about the actual operation situation that I
So want. You will be sort of, what I mean, you will be sort of very busy on the day that this actually happens, right? So when the rocket finally goes up. But that's actually a question, isn't it? I mean, what will you be doing on that day? We don't know exactly when it's going to happen.
Do you know?
We ask everyone, do you know?
I know more than you, but...
Yeah, you do, right. We've heard that as well. That's so annoying.
No, that's the you're the first person that's actually said that in those words.
And in not a condescending way. That's good.
Yeah, yeah.
We've also been told that you might sort of just try to talk to someone from ESAR Aerospace who will be here and we will see tomorrow. So we'll try again. Then when is it happening? But anyway, when it's happening, what will you be doing on that day? I mean, could you sort of describe what your work will be on that day?
Yeah, sure. So that's a funny question because as an operation manager, nothing.
Okay, interviewer.
Nice. Oh, thank you so much for coming. How are you doing?
So this is all in preparation then?
Yeah, the idea is if I did my job well, everything will be ready for the launch. So if I did my job well, I have nothing to do on the day of the launch. But I have a second responsibility, and it's an operational responsibility, and I'm the responsible of everything related to meteorology. So then on the day of the launch, I will be taking care of monitoring the forecast service, monitoring our local weather system and so on. But this is two different...
But it's mission critical, right? Because you want to launch in good weather. And as we've learned previously, I mean, rockets look very solid and powerful, but they are actually very vulnerable to weather, right?
Yeah, they are vulnerable to weather. Mainly we have two risks. It's lightning. So in this area, there is not a lot of risk of lightning, but we still have to check for this.
Sometimes you have winter lightning in Norway. So yeah, it's just
happen. Yeah. And the second is obviously the wind. So like you said, rockets are pretty powerful engines. So if there is wind, they can kind of correct their trajectory and they have some guidance, but it has its limits, of course.
Yeah.
So in case of very, very strong winds, it's possible that we have to delay.
Mm-hmm. And also... one thing that we have to ask early on, and let's do it now, is how did you end up in this field of work?
Yeah.
That's quite a story. At the beginning, I had a baccalaureate in literature and I made my study in geography. So nothing was...
literature and geography, that's an interesting combination.
Yeah, and I had this teacher of astrophysics and I was thinking it's absolutely fascinating what he's saying. So I kind of went to see him after class and say, okay, I want to work in space area, how can I do? And he say, well, so it was 15 years ago, you know, so he said, well, you have to be smart because geography, it's obviously not the good way to do it. But our satellites, they are getting better and better every year. And the imagery made with satellite are getting better. So as a geographer, you know cartography. So you should think about that. So what I did is I specialized in remote sensing. So satellite data treatments. Mm-hmm. And I did a lot of atmospheric science. Mm-hmm. And that was kind of my path to space. But it's definitely not typical courses.
But even so, it's fascinating. But so you had sort of, you wanted to do this, but and you went from these educations that wasn't really... at first glance, at least, looked upon as relevant. So you talk to people or you replied. I mean, sort of how do you... That again, is also a question. How do you sort of wiggle your way into it? Do you have any tips on this?
I was about to say I arrest people, but... Yeah, I mean, I knew I didn't have the perfect courses. So what I did during my study is multiplying internship. Like I knock at the door, please, can I come to make an internship? Even if it's like 2 weeks, even if it's for doing photocopy, I don't care. I just want to make an internship. And it's you know, it's a small area, space. Yeah. So you get to know people. And if they are happy with you, they will give you your chance. Yeah. And it's exactly my story. I went in a laboratory and I was doing these maps for the professor I was working with, and one guy he was from a laboratory connected to NASA, so he was an American guy, and for some reason he decided he was happy with my work. So the year after he contacted me and said, "Hey, do you want to do an internship in NASA?"
I have better stuff to do.
Think about this. The food in America is horrible. I know.
So yeah, it's kind of how it started, and I went to 3 months in Texas, in Houston, in the Lunar and Planetary Institute, which is one of the biggest.
Yeah, that's the big kahuna. That's cool.
Yeah, so laboratory in planetology, and of course with this on the CV, before even ending my studies, it helps.
Yeah,
of course it
obviously. Yeah.
But it's sort of interesting because what you're describing is sort of a profession which is not necessarily following a path and having all the right degrees. But as you say, it's still also about knocking on doors and sort of trying to find the right combination of experience.
Yeah, and you're good at cocktail parties, mingling then.
But the interesting thing is, we've also talked to some astronauts, and they're saying the same thing. Remember when we talked to...
I don't remember anything. Never remember stuff.
You can go back and listen to our previous episodes, and then you will see that, they also have also often very interesting starting points. And then they sort of try to find different ways to get into the profession. And usually when you sort of try hard enough...
You want it enough.
Yeah.
It happens.
Yeah. So, but then you get into this sort of... with operations manager dealing with satellites, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I researched you on your LinkedIn because that's what I found. And you talked about the SWOT mission.
Yes.
And the SWOT mission is a surface water ocean topography. And I have to say, I regret to say, we haven't talked about it. I think it's still on, right, the mission?
Oh, yes.
And it's an important mission, isn't it? What kind of mission is it? So just so the listeners know.
Yeah, so it's a very cool scientific mission. It was launched in December 2022, so like less than 1 year ago.
Yeah.
And so hopefully, yes, it's still working. And the idea, it's radar. So it's built in partnership with JPL NASA. They made the scientific instrument, and France made all the platform. So all the rest of the satellite, to make it simple. And it's a radar that measures the surface of water, so ocean, seas, on lake if it's big enough, but it can be centimeter precise. So it's really, really cool instrument. And the idea, of course, is to have an idea of how much water do we have on Earth and how does it evolve and everything.
Oh, so it measures the level.
Yeah, the level. Yeah, okay, yeah. Sorry.
So is it then also possible, for instance, to measure the rise in water, for instance, as a result of climate change?
Yep. Yeah, definitely.
Okay. Oh, that's really interesting. Then you have a sort of separate metric for climate change. But what was your role on this satellite?
Yeah, so I was part of a team called Flight Control Team. So a more fancy way to say it is was the one piloting the satellite. The idea is before the launch, our job is to prepare what we call the flight control procedure. So it's what you send to the satellite to say it to it, I don't know, move your solar panel, turn off this instrument, change your orbit, stuff like that. It's really the how do we telecommand the satellite. And so we are preparing all this process, making sure it was working the way it's supposed to. Spoiler, it's never.
So, okay.
It's a complicated machine. So yeah, we had to see if everything was working. Then we prepare all the operation, all the operation phase. So how do we do the first phase of the mission? How do we do some specific operation and so on? And then, of course, when it was launched, we had to deploy the satellite, turn it on, and make sure everything was fine. And then you monitor.
1202.
Det startet som en helt vanlig dag, med de helt vanlige rutinene, den vanlige reiseruten og det vanlige stresset. Helt til ingenting var vanlig lenger.
Hvorfor ser alle på meg egentlig? Har det skjedd noe?
Noen har lagt ut bilder av deg på nettet.
Hvis du rammes av et digitalt innbrudd, du ofte den siste som får vite om det. For sikkerhetens skyld inkluderer vi sikkerhetstjenester I våre abonnement. Bli tryggere på telenor.no/sikkerhet.
That's interesting because when you think about satellites, you think, well, I mean, they run themselves, right? They're autonomous, they're in space and they are pre-programmed and they just take pictures and they send it down to the ground and we receive them and that's data. But what you're saying is that at least some of these satellites actually need sort of a team of babysitters, right? Making sure that they are functioning and...
Yeah, they are big babies, like you said. So the idea is the first thing you have to monitor is collision alerts, but this is quite a big story.
Come on, this is a podcast. So collision alerts, is this when you sort of have space debris and stuff
exactly,
like that?
Exactly. Yeah. So it can be debris that are just in space and that are, of course, checked by a different space agency. It can be, for example, I know the American have a pretty good base on this, but there is other checking for this. But it can also be other satellites. So basically, when it's two satellites, it's more or less one space agency calling another space agency, and then the fight starts.
Oh, who is moving?
Yeah, who is moving?
They're playing chicken.
Oh, yeah, because... Oh. The idea is when you have a satellite, if it's not failing, what will determine how long it will last is how much you will move it. Because to move it, you will have to use gas to actually move from an orbit to another. So when you have no more gas, it's over.
So if you have too many collision alerts and you're the one who's always moving, your satellite's lifespan will be shortened. And these satellites, we won't go into that, but satellites like this, I think usually they're quite expensive, right?
Yes.
And you don't launch them every day. So, oh, that's interesting.
Yeah.
So how do you resolve this thing you talk about when they sort of...
So as someone from flight control team, I obviously do not decide that. It's more another team called the flight dynamic system. So it's the one making sure the satellite is moving. Maybe I do not go too much into details. But how do you decide? Well, you call, you see what happened. There is some agencies that are famous for not moving.
No names mentioned, but we leave it up to you to guess, listeners.
And and also there is a lot of discussion. So obviously, if the satellite is brand new, the reaction will be not the same than if it's something a bit old that will be finished in not so much time and so on.
That's... That's fascinating. It's a game of chicken. And do you then have like a red phone beside your desk that you used to get in direct contact, or do you have to call the switchboard and please pass me through the music goes on and nah, nah, nah,
well, one thing is how long in advance do you for instance a typical collision alert. Is this something you sort of, oh, in 10 minutes we have to move, or is this something, no, we have orbits and we know that within a few days, or how's the timeline here?
So it's not like 10 minutes. that's good, thankfully, yeah. So you always have several people on call. So they kind of know they could be awakened day and night. But usually you will know maybe, let's say 1 week in advance. It can depend on a lot of stuff, of course, but more or less 1 week in advance. Oh, okay, you know what? In 1 week, we may have some collision alert. And the closest you come to this alert, the closest you will have an idea if it will actually happen or not. Mm. So it happens that one day you say, okay, in 1 week, there is collision alert. And 3 days after, it's like, okay, drop it. It will probably not happen. Or... Take care. Okay. It will happen.
I had no idea that this was going on. I thought that all the satellites were launched into like, oh, have you? Here's your orbit, and you're all good.
No. This will be a dream. But
you knew this, but I didn't know this.
Yeah, I follow some people on Twitter who write about collision alerts. So I've seen that there's a lot of them, and also it's increasing, right? It's getting worse.
Yeah.
Obviously.
Yeah.
For obvious reasons, yeah.
Yeah,
because we're shooting ever more stuff up there. But this is, the interesting thing is, are there sort of, this all depends on how many satellites are sort of, or fragments are in a certain sort of plane of orbit, because there's not, all satellites don't orbit in the same kind of orbit. So for instance, here at Andøya, we will be shooting over the poles. I'm just ad-libbing now, because I just had an idea and it might be completely stupid, but are the orbits around the poles, are they more empty of these kind of things, or will you have as many collision? Do you think operators of satellites will have as many collision alerts, or will there be fewer? Is space above the poles more empty is sort of my question.
Yeah, I understand. So the polar orbits that we'll be using are quite popular one. It's a low orbit, so it's between... between 400 and 600 kilometers, more or less. And it's typically used for observation satellite. And yes, it's quite popular. So I'm not in contact with the one that will be making the satellite, but it will be definitely a topic, yes.
So yeah, so it will happen there as well. And by the way, since we're not talking about the satellites because that's the other customers, but anyway, on a sort of general level, why is it, that's also part of the reason why we have Andøya, is sort of, why is this polar orbit so popular for Earth observation, for instance, or is it monitoring? Is this sort of, are there any advantages to sort of going north-south rather than, for instance, around the equator?
Yeah, so usually I will use a draw to explain, but I will try to do it this way. So if you are orbiting toward north to south, the idea is you kind of move on longitude a bit at every turn around the Earth. Mm. So this way you can cover all the surface, all the surface of the Earth. So it's very popular if you need to make Earth observation because it will allow you to make Earth observation. Another orbit, quite popular as well, is a geosynchron orbit. Mm. So it's just, if you remember, I said between 400 and 600 kilometers, geosynchronous are like 36,000 kilometers. So it's something very, very different. Mm. And they are more rotating at the same speed of the Earth. So the idea is they stay always at the same point on the surface. I hope I was clear enough.
Yeah.
And so this will be typically used for meteorology, and also for telecommunication and stuff like that. Mm. So it's just different used.
Yeah. So basically, this is a popular orbit. The polar orbit is popular.
Oh yeah.
And if Andøya is able to launch enough rockets, they will have customers.
Oh yeah, we have no doubt.
Yeah. Yeah, but that's interesting because just a few years ago, people were talking about will there be enough customers? But the more I hear is that no, there will be because there's a big demand for this now.
Yeah, yeah. Now the prognostic, it's more like it's starting to be crowded, and there is
that is sort of that's also a problem, right?
I mean,
and also with the mega constellations. I mean, the Starlink is already up there, and then Jeff Bezos is also going to launch a mega constellation. So it will be pretty. I mean, if this really happens, it will be a pretty crowded place.
There is more and more international effort to do a law about using of space. So, for example, as you mentioned, I come from France, and we have a law called Loi des Opérations Spatiales, LOS. Yeah. And the idea is if you're launching from a French launcher or in a French mission, you have to make sure your satellite will be back until 25 years. Oh, yeah. So it's by law you need to do that. And I know the guys working in this are meeting more and more people to convince first Europe and then hopefully worldwide to do law about this.
Yeah.
Because it is... Yeah, a growing problem.
Yeah, but that means you're kind of dealing with disposal of let's say trash, so it doesn't stay up there. But 25, I mean, there are still going to be a lot of satellites, because if you take one down after 25 years, you're going to shoot a new one up because you still need the satellite, right? Or
yeah, I mean I guess that's sort of the idea behind, for instance, Starlink. Is that they've been talking about 42,000 satellites, and they will be losing about 8,000 to 10,000 a year. I see some people say,
yeah, but which means that they will be replaced.
Launches.
They will be replaced.
Yeah, they will be replaced.
So it won't deal with the operational crowdiness, but we will take care of some of the
debris. This billionaire guy who basically does what he wants. So this sort of is a bit that. I think we need a law. I think that sounds like a good idea. Anyway, you did this, and then you applied for a job here. Was that how it happened, or did somebody tip you off, or what happened?
No, I really wanted to come here. The idea is I loved my work in the control center of CNES, but I've for some reason I cannot explain, but I've always been a bit obsessed by polar region.
Welcome to the club.
I applied to go in Antarctica and everything. So anyway, so when I heard about Andøya Space and Andøya Spaceport, I was like, this is perfect. Because first, well, it's polar region. Second, it's space related. Mm. Also, it has this operational context that I love. It's really what I like to do. Mm. And the last thing, it's really exciting. It's
starting something new, right?
Yeah, it's starting something new. Yes,
I get that.
It will be hopefully the first... launch from European continent. This is so exciting. Yeah. I applied and I was very lucky. So here I am.
We talked a bit. I mailed you some questions, and one of the things you end up mentioning was this launch and early orbit phase.
Exactly.
Yeah, and that's what's that? We talk about that. That's also another term we just need to explain. Yeah.
Yeah, sure. So we called it by this short name LEOP because it's easier. Yeah. So let's
of course, it's an acronym.
It's an acronym. Yes, we have a thing about acronyms in our podcast. We love the especially the acronyms, but it's very obvious that the people behind it, they have been out in a bar and drinking beer, and then they sort of say, "Hey, this is a good acronym." So Juice, I'm looking at you.
So LEOP is like, the title describes it pretty well. The idea is it's the phase between when the rocket releases the satellite to the phase where the satellite is actually working on mission and everything is fine. Mm. So it depends. Some satellites, it took a few hours. Some satellites, it takes 10 days, like for SWOT. And some satellites for the James Webb telescope, I think it was 30 days or something like that.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
They had a really long...
Nerve-wracking stuff.
Oh, it was nerve-wracking, yeah. We had one of the scientists who works on it.
Oh, you were lucky.
Yeah. Nail-biter, yeah?
So, yeah, it's really... So the idea, your first mission is to deploy the sonar panel. This is like the main thing you need to do. Yeah. Because when that is done, it means you have energy, so you have time. So it's if that is done, already you can kind of breathe again. So this is the first step. And then more or less you kind of turn it on and off every instrument to make sure it works. And then slowly, you're kind of putting the instrument in the state you want. So it will be arranging the solar panel you want. It will be maybe move the satellite a bit to have the correct orbit. It will be just adjust the parameters, maybe adjust the threshold of alert and stuff like that. Like you're just starting the mission, making sure everything works.
And I mean, I think ESA is... has been promoted at promoting itself as sort of more of a small sat company, and I mean it's the same regardless of the size. You still have to do the same, right? If it's a small satellite, or I guess it's different when it has few instruments, but you still have to sort of verify energy and communications and everything.
Yeah. I mean, definitely, from what I know, at least the solar panel is something in common in all satellites. Mm. Then, depending on your satellite, for example, telecommunication satellites, they are using a lot of this, so it's each time more or less the same model. So you can have a lot of automatization.
Oh, yeah.
But the more innovative is your instrument, the more you have to, you know, take it slowly.
Yeah.
But then if it's a well-known technology, maybe it can be a bit more automatic. But it varies so much between mission.
It has to be like a horrible, horrible, horrible feeling in this phase where you say, we have to start. Get power, release the solar panels, tune them, and no.
Yeah, I mean...
And then you are dead in the water.
Yeah. I mean, I heard stories, you know. So, like, one of my colleagues told me that it happens to him to have a mission where the solar panels were not properly deployed. And he told me about they sent a command to kind of ask to all the thrusters to shake the satellite. And they managed to open it this way. And I don't know, but I will be freaking out. But, that's definitely the main point. Also, when the rocket starts and the satellite is released, you have to wait. It's come at the we have ground station of antenna, and the ground station of antenna are in some part on Earth. It's not everywhere. Mm. So we have to wait that the satellite is around the ground station. So it's. Depends, of course, but sometimes you have to wait a bit to have news from your satellite.
Yeah.
And it's...
1202.
Når du forestiller deg et innbrudd, så ser du for deg drama.
Okay, se om du finner noen passord.
Kaos. At noen tar på det som ditt, invaderer det du har nærest.
Finn kort informasjon.
Det som bare du og kjæresten din vet om.
Masse private bilder. Nydelig.
Men sannheten at mens et digitalt innbrudd pågår, så merker du ingenting.
For sikkerhetens skyld inkluderer vi sikkerhetstjenester I våre abonnement. Bli tryggere på telenor.no/sikkerhet.
Oh, that's interesting because we did an episode on the Deep Space Network, which of course is very big, very expensive, and sort of it's NASA, JPL, so they can afford 24-hour coverage. But I'm guessing that some of these customers. Who launch small satellites? I'm guessing that, as you say, they sort of have maybe one antenna, and you have to wait, and you can't afford sort of having ships spaced evenly around the world to listen to everything it says. Also, with these small satellites, it's much more common to have many satellites at once, right? So you don't have just one; you have a cluster of satellites, and then you have a lot of things. There's a lot of things going on at once. Interesting problem.
Yeah, definitely. And where I was working, they also had a future mission of 25 satellites. So I see it's a challenge. For me, I just had one baby to take care of, and I think it was enough.
one thing that I find fascinating is the thing you mentioned about you tell the satellite to shake, to kind of shake loose the. I find it because I know nothing about programming, computer programming, and that's what this basically is. It's sciencing the hell out of shit to make it do something it wasn't supposed to do.
Yeah. So
there has to be some level of creativity there.
Yeah, and I think it's a lot about thinking in advance to everything that could go wrong. It's basically the work, to be honest. So like the solar panel thing is something we really think about because it's the worst that could happen, I guess. But we have all procedures that we call nominal. So it's just how to take care of the instrument. And then you have another folder called contingencies.
Yeah.
And it's
that's
whatever.
Where the interesting stuff is.
Exactly. So whatever could be wrong, we are trying to think about the scenario in advance. But of course, sometimes we do not think about everything. So you have to be improvising.
Yeah, yeah, but that if you translate that way of thinking to your job here, to kind of think about all the things that can go wrong and to develop procedures to handle those things, you get kind of anxious.
Well, I mean, it's our job to get comfortable with it. Also, one of the wonderful stuff we have in Andøya Space, it's before the spaceport, there is 60 years of experience with launching sound rocket. So we have people working there that, I mean, they have seen a lot and they can handle a lot. So, of course, we're working, part of them are in our team and so on. So it's... I'm quite confident it will be good.
But hey, but if something in your job now, if something were to go wrong, or there is a problem that occurs, how critical is it that things happen fast? Do you have to do like you mentioned? Your responsibility is to make sure that everyone does their job and they know how to talk in the communications and to what button to press, right? And is it how critical is it that people react like instantly and press the right button in the right order?
I mean, so first, there is not so much scenario. I mean, we are launching a rocket. Either it goes on the right way, either it don't. So it's...
Yeah, well, that's also a way to put it.
That's very clear. Yeah.
I mean, so...
You should be in SpaceX.
Yeah. So the point is like... If the launcher is not going where we want it go where I want it to go, we don't have to think about why. We don't care. Our concern is safety. That's it.
Yeah, yeah.
As a launch pad, it's what we're taking care of. We need safety. So the only critical decision you have is do we terminate the rocket or not?
Yeah.
All the other part of the job, I mean, it's not that time critical.
Yeah.
But I mean, of course, I will not give too much details, but we are helped. There is automatism and so on.
Yeah.
But I think that one of the things we've learned, because we've been talking hell all day with people from Andøya, is this thing you... discover when you move from looking at space from the outside and you start to talk to people who are in space, that this is very much about teamwork, right?
Oh, yeah.
This is very much about the people. Yeah, the tech is cool, but basically it is a sort of, it's a propane oxygen rocket and we know the sort of technical principles and it has a guidance system and computers and satellites, our satellites. But again, it all boils down to the people and if they are able to handle it. Which sort of reminds me, in space history, we know this because one of the sort of really defining the things about the moon missions in the 60s was the brilliant team of people they had. Almost more than anything, it was sort of that they had plans and that they developed systems to sort of develop and manage all the millions of parts and sort of being able to get it to work in time. And this all brings me, you're looking skeptical, but I'm going to get to a question pretty soon.
Good. Yeah,
at the end of sort of 10 more minutes.
I wasn't skeptical, I was just contemplating and
thinking. Yes, you were sort of dosing off because it's been a long day and I was sort of droning on. But anyway, so I'm thinking the same here, that you have a team and you have many teams. And that's one of the things you mentioned in your correspondence with us is that all the different teams involved in this kind of work, which I think is interesting.
Yeah, definitely. And about the teamwork, I wanted first to say the advisor I had who teach me the operation, he told me something that I've always kept in mind, is like, we could forgive you if you make a mistake, if you are not on your good day and so on, but we will never forgive you if you are mean to someone or if you are not team-oriented.
Yeah.
That, because an operation, I mean, even the most clever person in the world, if this person is stressed, it will not be good. So you have to absolutely keep the good spirit among the team. And this is something very, very important. Mm-hmm. I used to debrief each time with our operational team. Okay, what did you think about the atmosphere? What did you think about the way this person told you that and so on? I think this is super important.
Do you think the teamwork and the work, this is a stupid question. Do you think it would be different if you had pursued your literature career and worked in a library? The stakes would be different, wouldn't they?
I mean, I don't know.
Come on, just say yes. Of course. Like I said, it's a stupid question.
Contra?
The stakes are different. Librarians and people.
I know many librarians. They're great people.
I was not saying they weren't.
You don't want, or we have actually some really hardcore librarian fans, and they are now. They're typing in a Facebook comment and saying, "What has Nils Johan against?"
I did not mean to, kjære bibliotekarer, det var ikke vondt ment.
He's now making a deep, deep apology. Very good. Okay, moving on. But again, it's sort of, yeah, different kinds of work.
The stakes are different.
One thing I'm sort of interested in, and you were, you did mention it, is that there are different ways of thinking and working in different countries. Like in my regular work, I give lectures and I talk about a lot to businesses, mm-hmm. and yeah, there's a very sort of clear idea in Norway, for instance, that management and teamwork can be different from, for instance, in many European countries, right? And do you have any experience with that? That sort of, for instance, informality. That's one thing that we sort of pride ourselves on in Norway. That's sort of. We say that, yeah, we're more equal, or at least we seem more equal, and we're more on a casual basis. What do you think about it?
It's very interesting. So I arrived in Norway in March, so more or less 6 months ago. And of course, I saw differences. The first thing that really was a bit obvious is... Here, people tend to give you the change more easily. Like you said, there is a very horizontal way of thinking. So I can really, yes, in a meeting say, oh, that's my point of view, and people will really listen. I will say in France, it's a bit more based on hierarchy. Of course, you can talk. But yes, it's a bit harder to kind of transcend.
Will it be considered rude for me to speak in this meeting?
Yeah,
but there are many. I mean, space has a lot of big complex organizations, and also American organizations have been criticized for the same thing, of a very hierarchical structure. The classic case is actually the Space Shuttle Challenger, which basically blew up because they had this incredibly strict chain of command where you sort of had a boss at the top who really made a horrible decision and nobody at the... And people hardly dared to speak out. They did some changes in NASA to make it better. But I'm thinking that that's the sort of management thinking that I think would be much harder here. And that's... So I just found it interesting that we're sort of starting... We're not just starting a new... chapter in Norwegian space policy or space practice. We have been doing it for 61 years, but it's also sort of maybe a bit different way of doing space. Who knows?
Yeah, yeah.
And that's interesting. So, right.
And also one thing I can have in mind is how to say in France. So a foreign will say we are more rude, maybe, but what we say in France is like we are criticized spirit. So like if we do not agree, we say, I do not agree. And we can be pretty tough about this. I think in Norway, people are much more polite. So they will say, you know, but you have to understand. Yeah. So at the beginning, I was a bit struggling with it.
Yeah, but that's true. I think we're a bit more conflict shy, which is not necessarily a bad thing, but sometimes it can be. But it's going to be very interesting because, as I said, you have all these teams, they're working together. And it's a big, huge, complex technical, but also managerial and also sort of human endeavor. I mean, this is there's so many things that's going to work together on that day, which you perhaps know more. Obviously, you know more about than we do.
When which day when, it will be? Yeah.
This is where you ask her very rapidly.
So we'll be again. Yeah.
We try to get people.
Good try.
Yeah. We try to get people to slip up. You did have a comment about something about launching in winter, and she's more or less confirmed that it's going to happen in winter. I'm just saying.
Let's see who says what.
But that's what everybody says. Yeah, everybody says December. That.
Yeah.
But we have a rule in our...
No.
It never happens. Nothing. When you say December in space, it's always at least January, February,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
But anyway, this was very interesting.
Yeah.
So thank you so much for taking part in our podcast. And we, of course, we're so looking forward to this first launch. And
whenever it will be.
Yeah.
So do I.
Yeah.
And on that day, you will do nothing. Oh, you will watch the meteorology.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yes, you will. And that's a really... I mean, this place has weather, right? That's, yes. You've already discovered it. Now I'm basically down to this is so exciting. And I think they have a really good opportunity here. But then that's weather. But on the other hand, I'm a bit gun shy after having been like you stranded by weather yesterday.
Here it comes again.
Yeah, I had one last gripe about the snow in Oslo, okay? That's
okay, da Eirik gått full...
Siste rant for en stund.
Vi får se. Ja, full sirkel der på været. Dette har vært Romkapsel, en episode på utenlandsk. Et språk jeg ganske sikker på at du mestrer, kjære.
Jo, men altså, du skal få en siste. Du kan takke av vår gjest på å si navnet hennes ordentlig.
Mona Petitjean. Petitjean.
Well done.
Yeah.
Was it right?
Yeah.
Okay, good.
You did it better than me.
Yay.
Be happy. Yeah. Thank you very much for coming here.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Du har hørt en podcast fra Podplay. En enklere måte å høre podcast på. Last ned appen Podplay eller se podplay.no.
På bussen, en helt vanlig torsdag, mottok Tore tilbudet som skulle forandre alt. En e-post, en lenke og en nettside med rabatter på det nye utstyret han egentlig ikke hadde råd til, men hadde så lyst på. Det eneste han rakk å tenke var at dette var nesten litt for godt til å være sant. Og det var det det var.
Over 70% av alle nye nettsider svindelsider. For sikkerhetens skyld har alle Telenor-kunder sikkerhetsfiltre som blokkerer falske nettsider. Se hvordan du kan bli tryggere på telenor.no/sikkerhet.